The microbiome's purpose is practically to regulate the absorbed amount of deuterium getting to the circulation. That is one of the most fundamental insights that Dr. Seneff provided for deuteronomics. This is actually the, I would say, one of the most critical questions to understand deuterium biology. Sure enough, atomic resonance and isotope resonance is a very important part of this process, simply because sunlight, the energy absorption through especially infrared light, actually communicates with our mitochondrial space. It's not just simple deuterium in your food that needs to be looked at. Closer to the equator, you have more photon pressure, especially red light infrared goes through your body and can actually decrease the viscosity of even higher deuterium metabolic water.
Welcome to the Richie Flow Nutrition Podcast. My name is Cameron Borg. On this episode, I had the pleasure of speaking with Laszlo Boros. Laszlo is a retired professor of pediatrics and current world expert on the impact of deuterium on human health. He continues to publish on and research the various effects of this heavy hydrogen in cancer and metabolic conditions from a quantum mechanical as well as biochemical perspective. Deuterium is the stable heavy isotope of hydrogen and, where substituted for regular hydrogen, can yield significant biological effects. With our modern diets so enriched in deuterium, its excess has become a serious concern for human health. Before we start, please consider subscribing to my Substack, where I share information that goes well beyond the scope of this podcast. I also share a solo podcast expanding on the contents of this conversation if you'd like to get even deeper insights into our discussion here. Becoming a subscriber is the best way to support my work and this podcast. With all that being said, I hope you enjoy the conversation. All right, Laszlo, thank you so much for giving me some of your time. I've been looking forward to speaking to you for a while. It's only now that I've reached out because I feel like I have a bit more of a grasp on this topic, and I think we can get a lot out of a discussion. So thank you for your time.
Sure, my pleasure.
You mentioned you'd like to start with the basics, which I think is a great place to start for a topic that is maybe not so complicated, but sounds complicated at the outset.
Well, it's only mitochondrial stuff, just to kind of get the basics of where we're going with this. So deuteronomics is now the field in science and in translational medicine and some clinical work that have very significant, and all the science around it have significant roots in mitochondria and ATP synthesis and fuels and nanomotors and so on. So I figured I would cover some of the basics of the ATP synthase and hydrolase nanomotor system. And that's the foundation where we, and from this level, we build physiology and biochemistry reasoning around deuteronomics. But it's practically now I can introduce this topic as a universal nanomotor user guide for natural and simple thinkers, simply because some of these principles are very uniform in nature and very influential when it comes to like seeing biological responses. And there's a logic and there's a table of content which I like to follow, just simply how structure and functional setup is imminent in the mitochondrial and ATP synthase nanomotor system. What are the universal structure and genetics components? What are the mitochondrial genetics and proteomics components? And what's the fuel that is proton? And what is the role of protons in mitochondrial physiology? And apparently that's where we cover deuterons as well. And how ATP synthase, which is very surprising, is an absentee in evolutionary processes. And there's more of a hint where design comes in and what are the nutritional consequences of these principles. So just to start with the very basic, this image to the right is from the Journal of Biological Chemistry, and I just share and cite this paper. It's an open access paper, but here you can see that these nanomotors, this is the inner, the top is the inner matrix membrane, inner part of the mitochondria, and there's a inner membrane protein component, which is labeled here as FO, and protons, which are the uniform fuels of these rotational movements of this ATP synthase, flow through the membrane, and that's where the rotor part comes in, because the protons attach to these rotating protein components to rotate this shaft that actually moves these ATP synthesis sites and locations of the ATP synthase nanomotor. Now, these details are very important in the sense that we do have a what we call a unique and uniform source of energy here, which is a proton working against or according to a gradient, meaning that there are about 260 protons in the inner membrane space. And while protons fall into the mitochondrial matrix, they form water with the help of oxygen. So this is where nutrition comes in, because that's where these protons are supplied from food, and oxygen we obtain from air. And in the meantime, we deliver energy, and we also produce carbon dioxide. So, which means that it's an internal combustion engine, and this ATP synthase or ATP hydrolase stator rotor system that operates through these proton pumps, and that's the fuel. It actually fits as an internal combustion nano engine with universal and unchangeable quantum physical, genetic, and biological properties. This is the, I would say, the most recent development to interpret these nanomotor functions in biology, in health, in nutrition, in life in general, and to see how determined these parts, these components of the systems of the system are, and you will see very surprised how determined it is and how stable it is in the animal kingdom. So the same structure of ATP synthase or hydrolase nanomotors are prevalent and are general in all kingdoms of life with multiple functions. So the nanomotor itself is the same in all living species, and there's only two kinds, especially when it comes to human cells, the F type and the V type, which I'm not going to talk in details, but we just have to keep in mind that these nanomotors are very preserved in all animal kingdoms and in all life forms, meaning that it seems like this design did not evolve over time. And in fact, they don't really know, evolutionary scientists, how these moving and stable stator parts of the nanomotors developed, or how they combined, and what's the evolutionary imprint or footsteps of developing nanomotors, because they don't seem to exist. And all mitochondrial proteins determine proton tunneling and are unchangeable due to monoallelic maternal inheritance, meaning that you only inherit mitochondria from your mom. There's no sexual kind of variations, and there are no alleles of some of the proteins that we're going to discuss with more details in a little bit. But you have to kind of keep in mind that all these proteins are very preserved in these nanomotors, and all these proteins can come only from your mother, meaning that the oocyte, when it gets fertilized, you don't really get, or you don't get mitochondria from your paternal side, meaning that your father cannot really supply you with genetic variations that would actually make or move or change these nanomotors because of genetic variations. These are monoallelic maternal inheritance properties.
Do you think that humans, this is one of the reasons why we evolved only maternal inheritance of mitochondria?
It seems that that's the case. They use this for very, because there are some variations in these genes. They don't affect certain parts of these nanomotors that control the size of these proton tunnels. And there are some other variations, so you can always kind of anthropologically or in the animal kingdom, you can determine the maternal size of inheritance, mitochondrial gene inheritance, and how they were switching genes back and forth. But certain genes, which are 13 proteins, the mitochondria carry with and in and within their DNA, which is a circular intron-free DNA with about 16,500 or 600 base pairs that have 37 genes and they code 13 proteins. Now, this is very important. What are these proteins that mitochondria carry with themselves and don't let change throughout evolutional biology, and why those are and how those determine the basic, very principal operations of these ATP synthase nanomotors. And it seems that, and we're gonna see evidence of that, but we know that now that actually to gate out deuterons or deuterium from the system because they break these nanomotors. So this is very interesting that the mitochondria would carry, the maternal mitochondria would carry these genes and these proteins with them without any possibility of interchanging with other allelic influence, meaning that the paternal side, meaning that these are very stable in all humans, and actually it should be that way. Otherwise, if they mutate, those are causing diseases that are incompatible with life. So they don't get inherited. Now, these are the 13 proteins of what the mitochondria carry, the maternal mitochondria carry to the offsprings. And the 1 and 2, they are affiliated with this FO subunit that are the transmembrane units of the ATP synthase nanomotor, and they control the protons that get attached to the rotating unit surface, meaning that because these proteins have no allelic variations, that means these are stable in life, and they all belong to complex 5, which is the ATP synthase nanomotor. There's one disease in the subunit 6, with some mutations. It's called Lake disease, and it's incompatible with life and inheritance. So it seems that even if there is a mutation of some sort, those don't survive in humans. The rest of the proteins involve cytochrome C oxidase, which is a very critical part of transferring protons and electrons for water formation, and those are part of this complex 1, 2, 3, 4, that actually oxidize hydrogen or the protons that fall in the mitochondrial matrix to form water, deuterium-free water, or matrix water, that's how we call it, that needs to be recycled into the circulation through fumarate hydratase and some other enzymes to supply your body with deuterium-depleted substrates for anabolic processes or molecular synthesis. There's one protein that is affiliated with cytochrome B, the complex 3. That's what we consider very important to control proton and not deuteron transfers through the membrane. And the rest, six proteins, they are related to NADH dehydrogenase subunits in complex one. That's the majority where protons are kind of pushed through the intermembrane of the into the intermembrane space of the mitochondria, and that those have also very important deuterium discriminating properties. So it seems that all mitochondrial proteins that actually are coded and are taken by the maternal mitochondria that we inherit genetically, they are encoded proteins that are gating out deuterons or deuterium from the both from the intermembrane space and also from the ATP synthase nanomotor through the FO subunits. So it seems that the whole system is set up for deuterium discrimination or regulation, and it cannot be changed genetically simply because there are no allelic variations in this protein synthesis process. Now let's talk about the fuel, the proton that comes from food. It's very important to recognize, to realize that proton is the smallest stable subatomic particle, and with one positive electric charge, and that's what we call the elementary charge. And the proton mass, so the one Dalton or the 10 to the minus 27 kilograms range, which is, that's what the 10 to the minus 15, I believe, is that's where the proton range is. The proton mass is a quantum physical constant that is universal in nature and independent of the system in which it is measured or used, in and obeys all relationships with other physical constants, Planck, gravitational speed of light, electron, neutron mass, and etc. So the one Dalton proton mass is the basic fundamental quantum physical constant that we cannot really change, meaning that it's totally independent from all systems where protons operate. It does not matter where we measure proton mass in the universe. It's always the same. And for that matter, simply the fuel, not only the proteins that transfer protons into the mitochondrial matrix or the mitochondrial intermembrane space, are very stable and unchangeable and universal in biology, but the fuel itself, the proton, links with mitochondrial operations with quantum physical properties and constants simply because it's one of those that is really independent from all other conditions that could change in life. So it seems that the operation and also the relationship with the mitochondria ATP synthase nanomotor system are embedded and rooted in quantum physics, and here where lights, temperature, viscosity, proton quantum destabilization processes come in as source of energy. Apparently, the momentum or the movement of protons are very important as far as energy is delivered through ATP synthase and the formation of ATP to biochemical processes. And at the end, the oxygen-hydrogen reaction, reducing oxygen or oxidizing hydrogen, forming water, produces also energy in the form of heat. So this is actually the most efficient way of generating energy from organic material, from carbon-based life systems, living systems. But it seems that as far as the ATP synthesis and the water formation processes in the mitochondrial matrix are very much determined by non-evolutionary principles, in the sense that there are no allelic variations, so there is no room for development or changes, and if there are changes, permutations, etc., or genetic incompatibility with mitochondrial function, those diseases are lethal. And for that matter, these properties don't get in further generations or succeeding generations. So, and this is just practically a summary of what I was trying to cover here is as evolutionary principles do not apply or do not seem to apply to mitochondrial fueling, which is the proton basic structure and functional components to protect, and the purpose of that is to protect our ATP synthase nanomotors. And these are due to the unchangeable and unchallengeable laws of quantum physics, which is related to the proton mass, and genetics, which is a monoallelic asexual inheritance. And these serve as the fundamental principles of human physiology and health. And that seem to rest on design with primary goal of continuous deuterium discrimination by moving proteins during life. So as long as we live, and that's practically while we form metabolic matrix water, because that's what is an essence of life, to make this water with the help of oxygen. If we cut oxygen, we die instantly, almost. If we cut fuel, takes a little bit longer because we have more fuel source in our body. But as soon as this water production and proton and deuteron discrimination process stops, then we would die. And I just wanted to refer back to Charles Darwin's quote from his book from 1859, The Origin of Species, where he said that if it could be demonstrated that any complex organ existed which could not possibly have been formed by numerous successive slight modifications, my theory would absolutely break down. But I can find no such case. Well, now we can, or at least we like using genomics and electron microscope, and with the help of technological improvements, it seems that ATP synthase, mitochondria, and deuteronomics, they appear to be such complex organ systems that prevent human adaptation to deuterium, rich processed food, or artificial life conditions. And this is practically because of how ATP synthase is put together, how high performance related to its water viscosity and oxygen, hydrogen, base water formation, and energetically balanced food sources, meaning that high fat, low carbohydrates, etc. This is where we, and this is how we position biochemical deuteronomics principles into general biology, or for that matter, chronic disease epidemics, or just like treatment of cancer with deuterium depleting or deuterium controlling approaches, and deuterium depleted water, especially that is produced in the mitochondria from grass-fed, highly saturated animal source or fat source, enteros, and so on. That's what we use with some of my colleagues as therapeutic approaches to treat chronic disease. So, I wanted to kind of cover this part so we have the same foundational information and concepts, and that can be summarized very simply that mitochondria and the ATP synthase nanomotors are there for a very uniform operation of generating energy, but the only fuel is protons, not deuterons, and protons are quantum physics related principles as far as their mass and their properties are concerned. So these cannot be switched, meaning that our mitochondria are not going to be adapting to high deuterium food sources simply because those are gated out from mitochondria. As soon as mitochondria are damaged by deuterons during this gating process, then metabolite crowding steps in, meaning that either storage of molecules and also the Warburg metabolism steps in, which is glucose lactate production. So after all, understanding these very basics of mitochondrial ATP synthesis related processes, I think after all, we can take a new look or a different look to human health, physiology, how light, oxygen, pressure, dissolved oxygen, peroxisomal metabolism, sporting challenges in general kind of fit into our general thinking, and what nutritional guidelines, or if those should be given, should rest on what information, because the basic foundation of the mitochondria and ATP synthesis operations depend on proton sources and all physical concepts and principles that improve this proton transfer, first from food or substrates to the intermembrane space, and from the intermembrane space back to the matrix to form water. So to attach hydrogens from carbons, kind of snip them off and attach them back to oxygen, where photosynthesis can start the same start the opposite process to produce organic food sources and organic matter, kind of what we consume and eat to generate energy. And all this energy is capturing the energy that comes from the sun, which is a huge proton mass of 10 to the 30 kilograms. And that's why resonance can actually work with this system very efficiently. But we have to understand the fact that this is a proton-based system. It's not a deuteron-based system. Deuterons are necessary for structural proteins, but they have no role or function in moving parts of the mitochondrial matrix. So if that covered it all, then we can switch back to our conversation.
This has made my job a little bit harder, because I have 1,000 questions based on just that, your presentation just now. But I'm going to, you can also stop sharing as well, so that the picture goes
okay.
back to,
sorry about that.
To us. That's okay. That was really eye-opening. And like I said, I have a lot of questions based on just that. But I'm going to continue by quoting a recent paper of yours to see if I can wrap my head around it. You write, evolution seems to depend on deuterium-related regulatory processes via submolecular proton tunneling event architectures with coinciding significant isotope fractionation properties. So it seems to me, and correct me if I'm wrong, that what you're saying is that these mitochondrial proteins are so conserved and they're so precise that the margin of error is essentially zero for their construction with these nanomotors and the way that they are tunneling protons. And one of the other things that they do as they tunnel, as they move essentially these protons in a quantum mechanical fashion, is that they act as a regulator. They only let protium or one proton, one electron through, and they discriminate against deuterium. Is this the general idea of why mitochondria have these such conserved proteins, and that they've maintained, I think you said 37 genes specifically for these proteins? They don't let them be transitioned to the nucleus, whereas all the other mitochondrial genes have gone to the nucleus. These have stayed for this specific purpose.
Yeah, because if you mix with nuclear genetics, then you're going to have alleles coming from the father's side. From that, then you're going to introduce genetic variations into the process, into the mitochondrial protein synthesis process. So mitochondria retain the synthesis of these 13 proteins that are all related to proton transfer from the matrix to the intermembrane space from the intermembrane space to the matrix to form water. So it's a deuterium discriminating or regulating process. And it's also important that because of the tunneling effect where deuterium has kind of a large kinetic isotope effect that needs to be kind of left out from this system or needs to be gated out. Now, interesting as it is, bacteria use this system just to retain deuterium, so they actually multiply prokaryotes, their DNA, very efficiently. But they actually use these nanomotors using ATP, they actually pump protons out and they retain deuterons. And that's the most efficient way. This is why our microbiome is invented, simply at the gut and the circulatory layer, it actually discriminates, fractionates deuterium more efficiently. So that regulatory process starts in a human individual at the microbiome or at the gut layer where microbiome interacts with the circulatory system. And their mitochondrial, they don't use mitochondria the same way as we do, but practically they use membrane pumps, which are ATP-dependent proton pumps. Yeast, those have been transfected into human fibroblast or mice fibroblast, and sure enough, when you retain deuterium in your cells, then they become cancerous. So it seems that these, what we talked about and what you capture from this talk, and those 30-some genes and those 13 proteins are just to fulfill this very basic principle, biological adaptation to proton-based food sources, deuterium-free metabolic water production, and being able to synthesize a DNA that can be packed into a nucleus and you can form a eukaryote cell which does not divide continuously. So you can actually withdraw from the cycle. And that's what practically differentiated cells do. They withdraw from the cell cycle, but they start using the packed DNA for specific protein synthesis. And for that, for this purpose, you have to control deuterium intake, and you also have to protect your mitochondria. And the way of mitochondria doing this, they don't let their genes, those deuterium discriminating little proteins that actually pump protons, they don't let any allelic variation, any genetic variation into those components. Everything else is fine, because if there's a genetic mutation, either the mitochondria falls apart or the proton pump falls apart, and but you cannot really change the system. You cannot adopt to a high deuterium food source simply because your mitochondria have no genetic adaptation to that process or variations.
One of the things I'm particularly interested in is how this fractionation process is going on. Obviously, you know, with what I'm doing at the moment, we're more focused on carbon-13 and nitrogen-15, but I would guess that the same principles apply for all stable heavy isotopes in how they are fractionated, how they are discriminated against. But do we have an idea about how these proteins, how these tunneling events, these architectures are actually discriminating between protium and deuterium?
Well, first of all, there is a size issue. Mm-hmm. When you look at the nucleus of deuterons, they are twice the size and twice the weight. We are talking about the nucleus. Actually, through these proton pumps, even the electron is ripped off of a hydrogen, meaning that the electrons start traveling through the electron transport chain through those cytochromes. Those are also carried, those genes, with the mitochondria, meaning that your mitochondria will not let you mess with the system that carries protons or electrons. So the intermembrane space have positively charged protons, and because of the nanomotors are kind of put together in a certain way that those proton tunnels cannot really incorporate or take in deuterons, which are too large, too big for these nanomotors to enter their structure. these little tubes, these little tunnels that guide the protons to the surface of these rotating FO subunit, they will gate out deuterons. If they encounter deuterons, there are proteins, we believe, that they collect these deuterons. If there are deuterons, or somehow make it into the mitochondria. And also what we believe is the urea cycle is one of the biochemical processes that can be useful in removing deuterons or heavy water or semi-heavy water from the mitochondrial matrix. So this gating mechanism is just one kind of mitochondria self-contained genetic process or preserve mechanism to kind of preserve the size of these tunnels where deuterons don't fit in. But if an individual eats deuterium-rich food, which is processed food or plant-based diets or industrial processed seed oils and you name it, or margarines or plant-based whatever, then mitochondria may encounter deuterons above the gating or the biochemical gating mechanisms, that glycolysis is one of those. And then the urea cycle steps in to help, or if deuterons travel into amino acids into the mitochondria, those can be actually removed by the urea cycle, which is another biochemical cycle that is related to mitochondrial operations in the TCA cycle. Now, carbon dioxide, carbon C13 and other stable isotopes are also important, but because the mass difference and the size difference of the nucleus is not as significant as between protons and deuterons, then they cause and induce some kinetic isotope effects, but those are never as large or never as significant as what we see with protons and deuterons.
And you alluded before to the role of the microbiome in this fractionation process. And I think this mirrors Stephanie Seneff's idea that the commensal bacteria in the gut play a very important role in basically going through all of these isotopes and picking out the ones that they want and getting rid of or allowing the heavy isotopes that aren't needed to pass through and leave through various other processes. And I was wondering about your thoughts about the role of the microbiome in this fractionation process. And clearly there are connections with all diseases with disturbed microbiomes. Clearly, if this is true, this is having an effect on our ability to regulate the ratio of deuterium to hydrogen.
I mean, that is one of the most fundamental insights that Dr. Seneff provided for deuteronomics. And I've been working with her for a number of years now, and she made some very important contributions simply because, and I think the most significant ideas of what she was sharing with us is that the microbiome's purpose is practically to regulate the absorbed amount of deuterium in the form of substrates that can get into the circulation, because prokaryotes, which continuously divide, they kind of retain deuterons, and that's why they constantly replicate their DNA and keep dividing, unless they are involved in deuterium depletion of lactic acid and glucose, which they form propionic acid and butyric acid and rip them off of their high deuterium hydroxyl groups and so on. So it seems that they, not only from food, but also from your circulation, and this is what marathon runners do, they develop a Vallianella bacterial colony in their gut that produces from circulatory lactate, they produce propionic acid, which is a 3-carbon saturated fatty ketone body, and they actually provide that for circulatory and for nanomotor protective purposes in long distance elite athletes and runners. We're actually writing a paper about this with Alex McDonald, who is a 5 times marathon, 5 consecutive days. He ran 5 marathons in the fasting state. And then a few months later, he did an ultra marathon, which is 100 kilometers. And he was able to do that in a fat adapted diet. And when we looked at his microbiome, we figured that he developed the same high propionate, high butyrate microbiome producing bacterial constituents based on his diet. So it's not exercise or not only exercise. In fact, if you're a fat adapted, natural grass fed, fat adapted sportsman, you can actually do almost like what others can do with intense training, simply because your microbiome can adapt to this very important process of depleting deuterium from food and also from your circulation. Now, once you start missing with your deuterium discrimination or deuterium depleting properties of your microbiome, meaning that you kill your most important with glyphosate and processed whatever, yeah, and poisons and processed food and so on, then your body cells will take over the deuterium depletion process, and that's how cancer develops, meaning that it originates from the microbiome. And deuterium, control of deuterium in your circulation is a constant task your cells will actually perform. And if the microbiome is damaged and deuterium depletion is not happening at the microbiome and the gut layers, then your body cells will try to control deuterium through various biochemical mechanisms, and hence there is a chance of developing cancer, especially at later age, in certain diets. So there's a lot of connections and a lot of very important insights of coming from the microbiome in the circulation, the circulatory processing, and how this deuterium control, that's what we like to use, how deuterium is controlled after all, but how you can assist, how you can help your body, your biology, by the best way of depleting, controlling deuterium, and that's through diet and that's through food.
One of the curiosities I find in the literature is that, you know, logically you would think that enriching an organism with deuterium slows the kinetics because the bonds become stronger, where hydrogen would be weaker than a deuterium bond, for instance. Things become heavier, and typically what you see is enrichment with deuterium slows growth. But what we see with things like deuterium depletion for cancer treatment shows something rather different. There's this idea by Roman, this resonance, isotopic resonance hypothesis, that predicts that enrichment of deuterium will slow growth generally until you reach a specific resonance point, which is enrichment of about 64% relative to the environment. And at this point, you get a complete flip. You get an enrichment, a speeding up of growth. And I find it interesting that that is the biggest deviation for all of the stable heavy isotopes. Enrichment of about 64% deuterium is something that really speeds up the growth. It creates these resonance properties. Mm-hmm. And this has been shown in a very interesting study with pigs. The pigs that grew the fastest had this signature resonance condition. So it seems like the deuterium's effect on the body is nonlinear. So it's not just, you know, depleting does one thing, enriching does another. There are all of these nuances in between. And one of the things that I wonder about quite a bit, because of this gradient that we see from the equator to the poles, generally there's much more deuterium concentrated at the equator, and the people living at the equator are consuming a lot more deuterium. A designation of bad might be slightly incorrect, in that deuterium is not bad. We need it for some things. But like you said, the fractionation and the differentiation where this deuterium ends up is very important. So How do we explain the enriched, relatively enriched deuterium content of the diets closer to the equator on biology? Because if we all have the same ATP synthases, we all have the same.
Sure.
How do we explain the excess deuterium being dealt with there?
Yeah. Sure. This is actually one of the most critical questions to answer to understand deuterinomics or deuterium biology more thoroughly and how that can be incorporated into the biological medical thinking. And sure enough, atomic resonance and isotope resonance is a very important part of this process, simply because resonance, the sunlight, the energy absorption through especially infrared light, actually communicates with our mitochondrial space. So where high deuterium diets are consumed, and that's true of the equation, the equator, that's areas or lands of close to the equator. And also there are vegetarians in India, huge populations that consume higher, or even Mediterranean countries, they consume a lot of fruits with sugars, carbohydrates, and they eat rice in certain parts of. So practically, it's not just simple deuterium in your food that needs to be looked at. You need to be looking at your microbiome, which apparently part of the system. Simply, if you go on a carnivore dieting, you're going to have less stool, meaning that your microbiome will adapt to the nutritional inputs or environment. And in the meantime, where you have you're closer to the equator, you have more photon sunlight pressure, meaning that because especially red light, infrared, goes through your body and can actually decrease the viscosity of even higher deuterium metabolic water if it's formed in your mitochondria, you may be able to stay and maintain or better mitochondrial function, simply because the rotational movements appear in a less viscous water environment.
Right.
Because the oxygen, hydrogen, and the oxygen deuterium bonds, they all respond to electromagnetic, including light radiation, but those have to be in a certain frequency, meaning that there's, and Roman is very correct in this sense, that it's kind of a stepwise change, simply because you adapt to each deuterium environment through various mechanisms and electromagnetic energy input or light sources, duration, frequencies, spectral exposures, and so on. Those are very important of making your mitochondrial matrix water less viscous. There are two very important new papers that are coming out. One is from Dr. Abdullah Olgun, who was the first who discussed ATP synthase nanomotor functions in high deuterium. That's a paper, I believe, in 2008, and I'm sure you read it. Mm-hmm. I cite that paper very many times, simply because he was able to show that deuterium, certain amount of deuterium, because of its different dissociation constant from molecules, affect biochemistry and ATP synthase rotations. And sure enough, now they are coming out with a new paper. They can show that certain levels of deuterium exposure change the conformation of these rotating proteins of the nanomotors in different ways. So there are stepwise implementations of those physiological and energy production systems to different levels of deuterium. But what we need to consider very important is that if a hydrogen is replaced with a deuterium using oxygen, carbon, and nitrogen, you are looking at about 8.5 times, 10 times, or even 14 times larger energies to remove that deuterium from those covalent bonds, meaning that it really affects these biochemical reactions very profoundly, but in the moving parts, and that's the structure element. And Dr. Zuberer was showing that in seals, in peregrine falcons, where there are high friction, you can actually reach high deuterium above 315 ppm, for example, in cartilages or bone, collagen, proline, hydroxyproline of those seals, which dive very quick, have to come back because they are escaping from killer whales and white sharks. I don't want to live in an environment like that. So you have to, your skeleton, your connective tissues have to adapt to that situation using dietary kind of adjustment, again, a microbiome-based. You can actually start using peroxisomal beta oxidation and kind of take the mitochondria out of the picture for carbon processing. You can actually use hydrogen peroxide supplied for as matrix water, because catalase can do those kind of supplement kind of or substitute functions, especially during sleep. We covered this with Dr. Seneff in some other papers. And I think the most interesting, and I would say the most fascinating paper that we published so far was with Dr. Zuberev in the Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences, because there we could show that there are, based on a paper that appeared with huge variations of deuterium content in carbohydrates and other molecules and fat and water in certain phenotypes, several phenotypes, we could actually link this with biological roles and evolutionary roles. And I think that's very important to understand, that evolution, adaptation is a very important part of biology. We are not questioning the adaptation part of it. But when it comes to nanomotors, they don't follow the same guidelines. So it's designed. Now, if you want, you can contribute this to a creator. You can contribute to this to a previous civilization with certain abilities that we don't have. Maybe there are some other ideas. I don't want to entertain all of these because I really don't know, to be honest with you. But, and I don't want to guess, but scientifically, when we look at mitochondria ATP synthesis functions, they all seem to carry their own genes, don't let any variations, allelic variations in the process, and those genes are all gating out deuterium from the water producing water synthesis and recycling system. So there is a very important deuterium discrimination process in biology somewhere, which seems to be by design. Now, how that appeared, I really don't know, or how that is possible, I don't want to guess, but truly those are very important principles to understand the biological system. It's not just the only purpose of understanding evolution better, or have a better idea of evolution, or adaptation, or the Old Testament, or the Tatar Laka disc, the little kind of artifacts or anthropological findings that we have from previous, and I'll talk about several thousand years as we go back. It's practically the most important guidance of this type of information is what to eat today to stay healthy, strong, and have a long, healthy life. And that practically really something that is embedded in the mitochondria ATP synthase machines, these little moving nanomotors, and the mitochondria to be able to preserve these genes and these 30. It's not that many, it's only 13 proteins.
Yeah.
Compared, it's only 0.006% of your genetic material. But those 13 proteins cannot be mixed up with anything else. And that's, I think it's very remarkable.
At complex four, oxygen meets with protons and electrons to make metabolic water. I don't think many people would think that we make our own water, but we absolutely do. And more than that, it's deuterium depleted, as you say, because there are these complex gating properties of these proteins that make sure that deuterium is excluded to a certain extent. And I want to know from your perspective, I don't know if we know this, but to what extent is that gating optimized? Is metabolic water ideally zero deuterium? Like we could imagine the matrix of a mitochondria with absolutely no deuterium, or is there a small amount that gets through that's sort of permissible for optimal function still?
Yeah, so we only make about like half a liter to a liter of like new water each day. And that has to be in the complex four in mitochondria. We make right. water some other ways, but it's not as significant to the amount as what we turn over, meaning that really practically you're adding a little bit of water, deuterium-free water, on top of what you circulate or exchange every day. That's about just like calculating in a very reserved kind of view. We are turning over about 7.5 cubic meter water a day. And it's easy to calculate because that's how blood you rotate through your heart. It's several cubic meters, meaning that really it's a very dynamic system. Now, new water is added, and that new water is deuterium-free, and it actually dilutes into the water that we drink and the water that we produce through glycolysis and so on, because there are other processes. So, in fact, those are very important regulatory mechanisms to gate out deuterium and add some water to the water amount that we circulate and recycle. But more importantly, the water that we add through our mitochondria, through fumarate hydrolysis and so on, fumaric acid and other intermediates of the TCA cycle, especially citrate, through shuttling, will become part of your fat pool, meaning that that's how you synthesize your fat. You shuttle citrate out, which is already using matrix water, deuterium-free water, for fat synthesis. So you can actually produce a low deuterium substrate source, which are fat or hydrocarbons that you can use in your mitochondria very efficiently for energy source, as an energy source, if you eat a ketogenic animal-based, highly saturated fat, long-chain saturated fat-based diet, that has to be low in deuterium simply because you synthesize those from mitochondrial citrate. And there is no substitute for that process either. You cannot produce fat from any other source other than mitochondrial citrate. So that seems like that's by design as well. So it seems that mitochondria discriminates and gates out deuterium not only simply for deuterium-free water synthesis, but also for low deuterium fat synthesis or adipose fat, like ketone synthesis, that preserve mitochondrial ATP synthase in another species that consumes that low deuterium fat. So it seems like it doesn't start with mitochondria, and it actually goes like in the very bottom of the food chain that we eat, that this deuterium discrimination or regulation or regulatory processes. So for that matter, this is a more complex issue, but the bottom line is that practically as long as you produce matrix or mitochondrial water from low deuterium animal fat, then your mitochondria has a much easier time if you live in latitudes or longitudes that actually have lower deuterium in the environment. If you move down to the Mediterranean or the equator, then you eat more fruits with higher lutein, sugar, carbohydrates, and so on. But in the meantime, you're exposed to higher photon pressures and higher or more intense light and energy that can actually make your mitochondrial water more viscous, meaning that you can still run your ATP synthase nanomotors embedded in those membranes. Some parts of those water soluble and water viscosity, especially the interfacial water or the structural water layers, are very sensitive to lutein. Besides, you can actually use, this is what we believe, those nanoconfinements, membrane matrix nanoconfinements of the membranes, because those are hydrophobic. There's also room for proton quantum destabilization for additional energy. So some of the biological principles that we see, like, I'll give you an example, the husky dogs up in the North Pole with the Eskimos, they eat 300-400 grams of meat a day, and they run 60 kilometers a day with load in the minus 20. I mean, you need to look for some, I would say, some mitochondrial adaptation processes and proton-based energy production, not only water production, not only ATP synthase, not only decoupling proteins and heat production, but you also need to kind of consider quantum destabilization of protons, which is another chapter of deuteronomics, and I don't want to talk about that at the moment, but it's moving in many different directions.
I want to ask if there's something intrinsically detrimental to excess deuterium coming from food, or for example, let's say, you know, I'm in Stockholm at the moment, and I can go and buy a mango that's grown in Brazil that's going to have a deuterium signature that's very different than what I perhaps should be exposed to at this location. If I ate that and then subsequently consumed an amount of deuterium depleted water that effectively cancelled out the excess deuterium, are things all square as far as deuterium fractionation is concerned in the body, or is there something specific about the way in which it comes from food that might be particularly or specifically rather detrimental to the body?
Yeah, I mean, it's both, in the sense that you should be eating local food and you should be eating local grown food and natural food, meaning that it's not really a kind of a food source or a fruit source that your ancestors, your microbiome, your community has not been exposed throughout the year.
Everything should be yoked together.
Exactly. Everything should be your own. Everything should be in your community. That is, you can kind of adapt to it through the appropriate microbiomes, sun exposure, oxygen tension, partial pressures, composition of other isotopes. Apparently, those have to be artificial food process, meaning that it cannot be processed, it cannot be genetically modified, it cannot. There's a lot of stuff that you have to kind of stay away from, that you, when you walk into a department store and you see those shiny apples and watermelon from whatever it is from, it's really not your food, in the sense that, first of all, they don't grow there, especially not at that season. And when you eat it, you don't have the light exposure, the oxygen partial pressure, and you name it. It's just practically really not something you should be try to oxidizing, you should be trying to kind of processing or use their deuterons for, and their high deuteron levels to be like to produce energy from, because it's not going to happen.
Can you elaborate just briefly on what you meant by oxygen pressure? Perhaps you meant that that's some sort of compensatory mechanism here.
Yeah, the partial pressure of oxygen comes from that's O2 that is dissolved in your body. So mitochondria is supplied by oxygen that comes through the hemoglobin that is dropped in the tissues, but there's also some oxygen that is dissolved in your blood, it's O2, and your peroxisomes can use that directly. That's why when you sleep, you have these sleep apnoes simply because you want to shift to a ketogenic substrate oxidation in the middle of the night. You want to be in ketosis by the morning time when you wake up. So your breathing slows down, you stop oxidizing. You want to deplete deuterium throughout the night for the morning hours when you wake up. You want to be in a ketosis state. So you burn up your glucose very fast after you fall asleep. You have these rapid eye movements, these muscle and tissue activities. And from 2-3 o'clock at night, you start oxidizing fat, and O2, the dissolved oxygen through peroxisomal beta oxidation, is the source of oxygen and hydrogen peroxide that is surely low in deuterium because peroxisomes can only use fat and remodel fat and produce hydrogen peroxide from fat sources, which are low in deuterium, and that can be kind of switched to the mitochondrial matrix or transferred to the mitochondrial matrix for catalase to make metabolic water from it. So by oxygen pressure and by elevation changes oxygen pressure, meaning that if you live at higher altitudes, then your body will adapt to a lower dissolved oxygen pressure. Then you start producing certain hormones that would increase for daytime activities, that would increase your red blood cell count to deliver more oxygen for mitochondria to be able to produce the same amount of metabolic water and thus energy. So in fact, that when you live close to the kind of the ocean water level, then you're gonna have a different oxygen pressure, oxygen tension, partial pressure in your circulation, and even a few hundred meters, that's why air always flows up in chimneys, even a few meters, a few hundred meters can change the biological settings of peroxisomal mitochondrial crosstalk. So, and peroxisomes produce low deuterium hydrogen peroxide that you can recycle in your mitochondria. So it's a very interconnected system. We wrote about this phenomenon in the paper that we wrote about this Himalaya climbing experience. And sure enough, we believe that, you know, by kind of retaining certain breathing practices, and there are Wim Hof, there are Buteyko, and there are some other breathing practices, those are actually changing these oxygen pressure, partial pressures, and switch metabolism from mitochondria to peroxisomes, and those can only utilize fatty acids or ketones, and for that you deplete deuterium through the system constantly.
Fascinating. So this is one of the reasons why the Sherpa, you know, are always in a ketosis when they're climbing at altitude. This is, and I've heard stories of people who, I think there's a guy, I wish I could remember his name, who tried to climb Everest, I think 5 times, and then he was, then someone told him he had to be in ketosis, and he did it easily the next time.
So Mr. this Ballinger. Is,
yes.
Wrote a paper about him. Yeah, it's 2017 in Medical Hypothesis with Dr. Senef. Yeah.
Yes.
And what happened to the Sherpa that was offered at 6,000 meters, a Nutribar, a protein bar, whatever? He died.
Fascinating.
You can't really, you can't mess with this system.
Yeah.
Especially not at high altitudes.
Yeah, yeah.
Sherpas, they live between 4,000 and 6,000 meters. That's where their camps are. That's what they eat, elk meat. They cannot really just run down to the foot here, you know, the hill just to get a McDonald's or something. They are in a very strict ketosis, for that matter.
This makes me curious about the current state of understanding regarding ketogenic diets as an adjunct treatment for cancer. It seems that the research has progressed very slowly, but it's looking very, very promising. Do you have any insights as to...
Yeah, it's a very important key element of this whole process. It has to be grass-fed, natural pastured animal fat. Otherwise, if it's processed grain fat, sick animal fat, it's not going to do any trick, or it's not going to help.
And is this because of the deuterium content of
the fat? Yeah, it's because of the deuterium content. Yeah, if you actually grain feed a cow the butters or other kind of fat, deuterium content can go up by 20 ppm. So it's really not a joke. And that's true with the, like, with all the GMO stuff, with all the, every species and every created kind of biological system have to, and that's the most strict role of, I'll give you a good example. In the Bible, in the Old Testament, in the Torah, in the Tetralogy disc, it's all imprinted in a way that when actually the Satan approaches Adam and Eve, he gives them fix with the highest fructose content in the Garden of Eden. When actually the Satan approaches Jesus in the after baptism, by John the Baptist, he actually wants him to turn those, after a 40-day fast, the Satan wants Jesus to turn those stone, those rock pieces into bread, meaning that wants to eat. Satan always wants to feed you first to kind of get your mind and get your body dismantled in a way that you're not really able to use your mind the best way you could, and that your brain function will be affected first. If you look at people who kind of switch from carbohydrate-rich, deuterium-rich diets to grass-fed, animal-based, ketogenic diets, their mental clarity is the first thing they're going to report to you, how much like better their thinking or how they see these improvements in their thinking and cognitive functions. So it's, you know, it's a very important topic to consider, but the food source, the source is more important. That there's an order, there's a certain step by step, just like you cannot really ignore the mitochondria, like by design, it's a deuterium discriminating property. The next step is practically what's the lowest deuterium natural food in your habitat, in your area. And then if you take these steps, then you may expect the best health there is that is available for you, and stick with this because that seemed to be kind of your future, how long you can keep this diet, this natural, local, with sun exposure. So it's not only your food your food items have to be outside or come from outside, you have to be outside as well. So, and barefoot and grounded and exposed to sun and cold temperatures and sleeping cold and so on. So it's all related to these mitochondrial water production processes and energy production. And that seems to be a very important key element of understanding health in general and how to stay away from disease.
So presumably there's a limit of deuterium to hydrogen that the body is capable of satisfactorily dealing with as far as keeping the mitochondria relatively deuterium free. Is the general idea that when that deuterium level reaches a certain point where the gating capacity is no longer able to do what it's supposed to do and keep deuterium out, this is what initiates disease? Or is it sort of the other way around, or potentially both, where this gating, perhaps even through the microbiome, this gating capacity is damaged, which then leads the whatever deuterium is there to enter? Is it both scenarios are true?
Yeah, it's practically, as long as you keep your deuterium low in your food and your consumables, what you consume, your microbiome is able to discriminate sufficient deuterium, meaning that you're not going to have much deuterium in your circulation. Not as much as if your microbiome is damaged, you eat high deuterium processed food, then your body cells have to, through glycolysis and the Warburg phenotype, have to start dealing with the excess deuterium. And that's when chronic disease develops. That's what we call chronic diseases, because they develop slowly without early symptoms. And then when it comes, they're hard to reverse, meaning that then those are practically indicating like permanent damage to this energy-producing combustion system. You cannot exhaust all the carbon source or carbon dioxide that is necessary for water production and ATP synthesis, but there's going to be like alternative shift and bypasses in metabolism, single carbon cycle, lactate production, and you name it. It's practically just a catch-22. Once you start messing with your ATP synthase production, energy production, just because high deuterium food consumption and there's a leaky gut that is kind of part of this damage to your microbiome and your epithelial cells, then your body cells have to deal with deuterium, higher deuterium, and like they have to use glycolysis more intensely, those triosphosphate and hexosphosphate isomerase reactions that actually produce water from enduring glycolysis to get rid of deuterium and try to replace those with low deuterium matrix water derived protons that are not deuterium depleted any longer. So it's really then you're kind of in a kind of a vicious cycle of beneath biochemistry concerned, and it's very hard to change after all. But you know, there's always time to change, meaning that there's always way of starting and there's always room for improvement, and so it's never late to start.
So what are you working on currently? What are you hoping to continue contributing to this field over the next few years?
So we're going to work on this proton quantum destabilization process in mitochondria, when and how it's possible. One of our early collaborators from San Diego and from Saudi Arabia, now he moved to the US and he got his green card. He was a collaborator of us, a young gentleman. And we are working with a team of my previous institute. I retired now from the University of California, but I still have collaborations with a few investigators there. And I would like to continue my work with Dr. Zubarev. And if you want to join us, you need to talk to Roman and find some projects. But sure, you know, we keep writing papers, we start publishing, we start thinking, we start exchanging. We still kind of share some ideas with Dr. Senef and collaborators. So it's just a constant, continuous, and never-ending process. But deuteronomics is there.
Well, I'm very grateful for the work you've done. It's made it a lot easier for me to try and learn and understand these concepts as deeply as possible as I dive into them. I wanted to just thank you for your time and efforts.
Sure.
Really appreciate it. I know people appreciate your candor on these issues. It's very, very important that people understand this and the treatments out there and how important it is to dietary choices as well. So thank you for all your work and I appreciate it.
Thanks. Sure. Thank you for this conversation.
Thank you so much for listening. I really hope you enjoyed our conversation. If you want more, I have an additional solo podcast available on my Substack, expanding further on our conversation here. I've also left a selection of relevant links in the description if you'd like to learn more about Laszlo's work and our discussion topics. Again, if you'd like to support my work, please consider subscribing to my Substack, as it is where I share most of my thoughts and insights that go beyond the scope of this podcast. Make sure to follow on Instagram and X so you don't miss a post or a podcast. Thanks again for listening, everyone. Take care.